Don't forget. Okay, we're recording.
We already have questions, Hugh. Do you want to
sure, that's fine.
Start answering them?
That'd be good. Let me get my background light on.
Yeah, and I'm having...
And your background light is great, Ross.
Okay, good. Yep.
Best.
Okay, Hugh, are you ready for a question?
Sure, let's go for it.
All right, from Doug McComb. When planets first appeared on dry land, did they emerge from seeds exclusively? Were there any transitional forms? Also, when trees first appeared on dry land, were they created fully mature with rings, etc.? He says, essentially, what I'm asking is the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, in terms of advanced animals, the chicken would need to come first because the eggs can't take care of themselves. But if we're talking more primitive life like plants and, you know, microbes, you know, even things like most amphibians, then it's quite possible that the egg could come first because, you know, immediately they're able to take care of themselves. So it depends. And the Bible doesn't tell us which. But in terms of the advanced animals, it's got to be the chicken because they require care from the parents. I mean, that you see that with Adam and Eve. They were created as chickens, not as babies.
Thank you, Hugh. I want to tell everybody as you ask questions, I want to limit everybody to two question marks in their question. You want a question mark ration. Try to ask your question. One question would be preferable. Two questions is fine. Three, I think I'm going to just ask one or two and hold it for the next time. So
that helps me too, Ross. And yeah, there was a second part of the question there. Would God create a tree, for example, with rings already in place? And there's no room in scripture for, you know, any kind of deceit or deception. God wouldn't do that. As far as a tree is concerned, there again, the egg can take care of itself. You could start with a seed.
Thank you. Craig McMahon has a question. He says, in chapter 6 of your book, Improbable Planet, there is a discussion of the problem explaining the characteristics of Mars formation, but it sounds as though the jumping Jupiter idea was seriously problematic. I think in the last series, you mentioned a better explanation, but I have forgotten what it is. Would you please recap what that current explanation is? Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, the jumping Jupiter phenomena, that really talks about how we got really rapid inward movement in Jupiter, a stoppage, and then a rapid reversal. Something similar happens to Saturn as well. And the initial model was one where the reversal of the migration going from inward to outward happened when Jupiter and Saturn had a 1-2 resonance, which means that Jupiter is making exactly two orbits around the sun for every single orbit that Saturn was making. But they discovered that they wound up with much too large of a Mars when they did that. The new version is where we got Jupiter and Saturn going into a 3-2 resonance. And so that's where Jupiter makes three orbits around the sun for exactly every two orbits of Saturn. And with that model, and it also requires something else, you need to have a 2-3 resonance, plus you need a third ice giant planet. So the solar system would begin with Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and another planet about the size of Neptune or Uranus, where that third ice planet gets kicked out of the solar system or kicked into the very, very far reaches of the solar system. That model gives you a Mars of the mass that we see. It actually explains the masses of all four of the rocky planets in our solar system. So that's kind of the great success of the Grand Tack model. But it does require a third ice giant planet to complement the two gas giant planets for it to work. And it requires it to be a 2-3 resonance.
Thank you, Hugh. We don't have another open question, so I'll ask my own question to follow up on that. I remember when I first started following you and Reasons to Believe about a little over 20 years ago, you had even then quite a few examples of fine-tuning. With this Grand Tack model, have you tried to quantify how many features of fine-tuning there are for the solar system?
Well, that was a major scientific critique against the Grand Tack. It's like, you know, for this to work, you have to have dozens of different features of our solar system fine-tuned. However, the people who came up with the Grand Tack responded by saying, there is no other way to explain the current features of the solar system. I mean, if you don't like our model, come up with an alternate model, and no one's been able to come up with an alternate model that doesn't involve even more fine-tuning. And so the NICE team basically says, yes, lots of fine-tuning in our model, but it's a minimal amount of fine-tuning to explain the features of the solar system. And none of the people who have been writing these papers are actually suggesting any of the philosophical or theological implications. But I think they recognize that they are there. If you got that much fine-tuning, and the fact that we see no other planetary system with these features is basically... I think the implications are obvious. However, it's kind of protocol in the scientific literature not to get too specific on those matters.
Yeah, and isn't the fine-tuning kind of inescapable? Any model that they come up with is going to have loads and loads of it, isn't it?
It's like that with the moon-forming model, too. I mean, people say, yeah, you might not like the fine-tuning, but any other alternative is going to have even more.
Good. Okay. Our friend Stephen Posta in Spring, Texas asks, last week you indicated that those born during the millennium won't die until the end of that era, when Satan is released from holding and will be able to tempt all those born during the millennium. Can you speculate on what physics will change to permit this longevity in humans once again?
Well, okay, what I did say last week is that the text says that during the millennium, you know, anyone who is born during the millennium who lives only, say, 300 years will consider to have died a tragically young death. So it indicates that, yes, some of the children born during the millennium may. I use the word may because there's nothing in Scripture that explicitly says that they will. But that it would be rare if it were occurring. And exactly when during the millennium these children are born, again, the text is not specific. And again, this is unique to people who take a premillennial interpretation. As I mentioned last week, there are serious Christians who take those passages as not referring to a literal 1,000 years, but referring to a church age, which we're already in. And Mark, for people watching your video, there looks like there's some kind of finger or whatever in front of the camera.
I think you're talking to Ross.
Talking to Ross.
Yeah, Ross's video freezes occasionally.
Okay, it's fine now.
Yeah, the problem is, Hugh, I cannot get my computer to work, and so I've got my phone propped up in front of my computer, and every time I push a button on my phone, you guys see it, so that's just the way it is.
Okay, frustrating. No problem.
All right. David Edwards asked, please comment on what the horizon problem is within the Big Bang model, and if it is really still a problem. Is this addressed in one of your books?
Yeah, it is addressed in one of my books. It's addressed in A Matter of Days, the second edition. And it's a problem that's being raised by young Earth creationists, and they're intimating that astronomers have no solution to the horizon problem. They do. And so that kind of upsets me about young Earth creationists. They say, you know, this is a killer for an old Earth model. It's a killer for the Big Bang, intimating we astronomers have no solution, but we really do. The horizon problem is trying to explain how it is that we have the universe thermally connected. So that all different objects in the universe are thermally connected with one another. How it is that we have that in the context of galaxies and stars so far apart from one another. And basically they're saying in the Big Bang universe, if you got the universe expanding for 13.8 billion years, then we can't explain how it is that all the stuff in the universe is thermally connected and the universe as big as it is, but the objects are separated as far apart from one another as it is. Well, the solution astronomers have proposed all the way back to 1981 is that at that moment, when you got the strong nuclear force separating out from the electro weak force, that's when the universe undergoes a very brief period of hyperexpansion, what's called the inflation event, where for between 10 to the minus 35 and 10 to the minus 32 or 33 seconds, you got the universe expanding millions of times faster than the velocity of light. And it's that inflation event that allows the universe to be as young as it is, only 13.8 billion years, as big as it is, and everything being thermally connected. And those are all requirements for life to exist. So as I pointed out, in a matter of days, just to have physical life exist, we require that this inflation event occur. Young Earth creations are also being deceptive in claiming we astronomers have no measurable evidence that inflation has occurred. They just say, we invented that, speculated that to save our model, to save the Big Bang, and to save the idea that the universe is 13.8 billion years old. As a matter of fact, and this is written in detail in a matter of days, is that when we astronomers measure the polarization signal of the radiation left over from the cosmic radiation event, what is commonly referred to as a cosmic microwave background radiation, the Planck satellite, along with the WMAP, has mapped this in great detail, and there are instruments now on the ground that are measuring the polarization signal. And that polarization signal tells us that indeed an inflation event has happened, because it actually measures something called the spectral index in the cosmic background radiation. That spectral index would measure to be exactly 1.0 if there was no inflation. If it was simple inflation, it would measure exactly 0.95. If it's complex inflation, it's going to measure between 0.96 and 0.97. And in my book, I give you the actual measurements that have been done at multiple locations. Matter of fact, I think I wrote a blog. They don't have to get the book. They can get a recent blog I wrote at Today's New Reason to Believe, where I explain the latest measurement of that spectral index. It's close to 0.96, and the error bars are now so small it removes any doubt about an inflation event happened. You know, we're a good 7 standard deviations away from saying no inflation occurred. And so, and literally every year that goes by, the evidence for this inflation event gets stronger and stronger. More measurements are going to be coming from the South Pole Telescope probably within the next year.
Thank you, Hugh. We have a question from Karina Malko, who was our wonderful speaker a couple of weeks ago. She says, hi, Hugh.
Hello, Karina, and thank you again for taking over for me.
Yeah, she did a great job. She says, I was checking a recent paper in which they claim that considering an aluminum 26 enrichment in the surface of protostellar disks due to protostellar cosmic rays may provide a general pathway for aluminum 26 enrichment in our solar system. And then, Hugh, I'm sorry, Karina, there's a sentence that I don't understand, so I'm just going to skip it, but I'm going to go to the end of the question. She says, have you seen this study? Do you think this will somehow weaken the case for the creator? Thank you.
Yeah, there's been a lot of papers published on the solar system being super exposed to aluminum 26. For those of you that are not astronomers, we got aluminum 27, which exists in great abundance in the crust of the Earth. It is stable. Aluminum 26 is highly radioactive. There's none of it left because it decays over the course of just a few million years. But the early solar system evidently was bathed in a whole lot of aluminum 26. And being bathed in a huge amount of aluminum 26, it explains why the planets in our solar system are so deprived of volatiles, that is the light gases, because aluminum 26 was blowing that away. And then there's papers published making the point that this indicates that our solar system must have been born in the vicinity of Wolf-Rayet stars. These are really big stars, or supernova events, or a combination of the two, to explain how we were so saturated in aluminum 26. And you know, one piece of evidence for that is all the aluminum 27 we have on the in the crust of the Earth. Our planet is super endowed with aluminum. And to explain all the aluminum 27 we have, it's the third most abundant element in the crust of the Earth. And elsewhere in the solar system, it's quite rare, yet we've got this superabundance. But that would fit us being exposed to a lot of aluminum 26. I'm not sure I've read exactly that paper, but there was a paper that came out 2 or 3 weeks ago that was kind of making the same point. So Karina, I'd have to actually check to see if that's the paper I'm thinking of. It may not be. But again, just putting aluminum 26 into the NASA archive site will pop up all the recent papers on aluminum 26. I know one of those papers has actually been claiming we didn't get exposed to a lot of aluminum 26. But I know that paper is an outlier, has been responded to. There really is a strong consensus in the astronaut community that we got exposed to a lot of aluminum 26. It's really difficult to explain how deprived we are of volatiles without that aluminum 26 exposure. As I mentioned, it'd be difficult to explain why we got so much aluminum 27. What's interesting, our paper's saying maybe there's some way that the stuff that the Earth was made out of got more exposed to aluminum 26 than we see in the rest of the planets, because it seems like our planet Earth has a lot more aluminum 27 than we see in other planets. That's still an open question that's out there.
Very good. Thank you, Hugh. Well, it's 10:47, so let's get class started. I want to welcome everybody to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. Hugh, do we have the recording button on? Is it?
And that recording button's been on all along. So yeah, the Q&A all got recorded.
Excellent. Hugh, you're going to be gone next week. Tell us where you're going to be.
Well, Kathy and I are actually going to take a short vacation. So we've been waiting to do that for a long time. So we're going to be able to get away. And I appreciate that you and Ross are going to be able to step in and make things work for us. And, you know, I was also, I'll tell you what, I'm going to open the class in prayer, and I'll explain some of the new features we're going to try to build in to the Paradoxes class.
Before you get going, Hugh, do you mind if I say a couple of more things?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I just want to remind everybody something I said a few minutes ago. As you ask questions, we're happy to take as many questions from you as you have, but I'm limiting everybody to two question marks in their question. Please try to give us questions that don't have a whole bunch of parts to it. It would be very helpful for me trying to figure them out and for you trying to answer them. And then I wanted to say that next week, Hugh's going to be on vacation, a real vacation, not a virtual vacation. And Mark Perez and I are going to be filling in. And I wanted to tell everybody what we're doing. Mark, you want to say something or you want me to do it?
No, you can go ahead and do it. But I do want to mention that last week, I accidentally ejected somebody from the class. I don't know who it was, but I know that I bumped somebody out of the class and they couldn't get back in. So to whoever got bumped out of class last week, I sincerely apologize. It was an error, and you're welcome back in. And I just wanted to apologize for that. It was a mistake. Okay, go ahead, Ross.
Okay. So just let me talk for a minute on what Mark and I are going to talk about. I have a friend who told me once that when they figured out that evolution was probably true, they stopped believing in God. And it got me thinking. I realized, you know, there's a whole lot more reasons for believing in God than just evolution. And I thought, you know, I think everybody who's a Christian has one or two or three favorite evidences for God. But the truth is, there's really a couple of dozen very powerful evidences. And Mark and I are going to try to fly over at 30,000 feet and touch on every single one of them for just a minute or two, because we want to try to give everybody the vision that this is a huge body of evidences. And most people, when they talk about evidence for God, pick one or two or three. We're going to try to touch on every single one and overwhelm you with all of the different pieces of evidence that exist, so that you can look at them and say, wow, I don't know anything about that one. I'm going to go look into that one, because a lot of them may be unfamiliar to you. So that's what we're going to do next week. Mark, you want to say anything about it?
No, I think the bottom line will be that we'll be using evidentiary as well as philosophical points. So whether you're looking for some kind of philosophical answer or other kinds of answers, we will have at least a smattering of both kinds in there. It should be very interesting.
Yep. Yeah, we're really looking forward to it. And Hugh, you're going to try something new in class this morning. So why don't you open us in prayer and tell us what that's all about?
Let me unmute myself first. Okay. Father in heaven, we thank you for this beautiful day. Thank you for giving us another day to enjoy your creation here and to enjoy one another, but particularly to enjoy you. Father, I pray we'd all be open to receiving more of your love, life, and truth. And Father, that you would equip us to be able to share reasons with one another and with those that don't yet know you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. So bless our time today. I pray that we'd be able to encourage one another. In Jesus' name, amen. Yeah, what I'm going to try to do, there's been some significant improvements in the Zoom software, and we're going to try to exploit some of those today to try to make this Paradoxes class more like it was before the pandemic hit, and more improvements are coming. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach for about 15 minutes, and then I'm going to invite all of you into a meeting. Zoom has webinars and meetings, but the webinar feature I have here does not yet allow me to put you into breakout groups. The meetings do. Now, I've got someone at the Reasons to Believe headquarters working on seeing if we can upgrade our webinar software so we can actually do breakouts right within the webinar. But today what I'm going to do is, after 15 minutes, I'm going to show you a slide that gives you the URL to join the meeting along with a passcode. I was told we need a passcode to maintain security, so we're going to do that. And all of you will be able to join in a meeting. And once we're all in the meeting, I'm going to be able to break up our team into probably a dozen different meeting groups. And in those meeting groups, I'm going to ask you to address certain questions that I will be giving you. I think it's going to be fun. We'll be able to turn all the cameras on. You'll be able to see one another, talk to one another. And I'm really hoping that this will be a time when you can feed back to the rest of us what you've discovered, and this way we can teach and bless one another. So this will be an experiment, and I think we're going to be able to make it more seamless in weeks to come. But again, I would appreciate any feedback I get from you. I am going to leave the webinar open because I know a lot of you join late. And so anybody who joins late, they will be able to be instructed how to join the meeting. And the way I got it set up, it appears that I can only make the meeting go for 45 minutes. I'm going to keep you in the breakout rooms for about 15 minutes. And then we'll come out and I'll take questions while we're in the meeting. And we run out of the 45 minutes, we'll go back to the webinar. So that's what's going to happen. And don't panic. I am going to give you the URL and the passcode and make sure you all got time to write it down so we can all join and be part of this. And hey, if anything goes wrong, we can all come back on the webinar, but I'm anticipating nothing will go wrong. So with that, let me share a screen. And this is kind of where we ended up last week. All of you should be seeing this slide where I talk about how atheists rebut theism. They claim that if indeed an all-powerful, all-loving God exists, such a God would never subject his creatures to evil, suffering, pain, and death. There wouldn't be carnivorous activity. Nothing would be experiencing pain. And I'm basically saying this is the single positive argument for non-theistic worldview. All the rest of their arguments are basically pointing out how we Christians don't do a good job of giving evidences for our faith, but this is the one piece of evidence that they have. And then looking at how we can respond to that by saying, well, if you're claiming that an all-powerful living God wouldn't subject us to so much evil, suffering, pain, and death, then where does all this evil, suffering, pain, and death come from? And I've actually experimented with this on my social media page for the last 2 weeks. And what's interesting is so far, 100% of the responses coming from people who are not theists is to say that the evil, the suffering, and pain, and death comes from the second law of thermodynamics and from some kind of naturalistic evolution. However, as we closed off last week, we made the point that when you actually look at the degree of evil and suffering and pain and death that are occurring, particularly amongst us human beings, it defies the capacity of thermodynamics and naturalistic evolution to explain. I mean, as you look at this photo taken in 1944, of thousands of Jews being herded into Auschwitz, we recognize that thermodynamics and naturalistic evolution cannot explain the very high levels of evil, suffering, pain, and death that are being experienced by us human beings. I think you could make a point that thermodynamics and naturalistic evolution explains the pain and death that you see outside of the human species. But once we look at the human species itself, we see there's a completely different level of evil and suffering that's being expressed, and basically making the point, the problem with a non-theistic worldview is they underestimate the degree of evil that exists in the world, particularly amongst us human beings, specifically amongst us human beings. I mean, when you see how Germany, for example, during World War II, wasted huge millions, literally millions of valuable labor contributions that if they exploited them properly, they might have won the Second World War. But instead, they took these millions of human beings, not just Jews, but Gypsies and others, Christians, and basically killed them off. The very labor pool they needed to try to seek success, they wiped out. This is what's referred to as in philosophy as spite. Spite is where you do harm to others, where it actually harms yourself to do it. You know, naturalistic evolution would say, well, they're committing harm against other species because they can benefit from this harm. But not only do they not benefit from this harm, it actually brings them more harm. And so it defines rationality, the degree of evil. And of course, this is not just unique to Nazi Germany. and we see it being expressed in Lenin's Russia and Stalin's Russia, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong in China, and you can go all the way back thousands of years. This has been a common feature of the human species, an expression of evil far beyond anything that can be attributed to natural processes, which leads you to the conclusion there indeed must be a good God out there that's opposed by supernatural evil being or beings. And this, of course, is the heart of the Christian message, that this indeed is a case. But again, as I've expressed this to people who take a non-theistic perspective, they say, yeah, I understand that we really can't explain the degree of evil that's being expressed by human beings by just these naturalistic processes. They're saying, maybe we're overlooking something in the world of nature that explains all this evil. But again, I've run into non-theist scientists who say, we've looked, we really can't find anything. This is a huge problem for our non-theistic worldview perspective. But they would counter in saying, you Christians also have a problem. And that is okay. We do see a surplus, a surfeit of evil and suffering going on beyond what we can explain by natural processes. But why would an all-powerful, loving, all-living God need so much suffering and evil? And this is actually brought out in discussions I had with the particle physicist Victor Stenger. As many of you know, I debated him at Caltech at the International Skeptic Society Conference. It was a friendly debate. And Victor has written books, many books promoting atheism. He passed away recently. But probably in his best-selling book, God, the Failed Hypothesis, reached the New York Times best-selling list. This is a comment he made. Does God really need so much pain and suffering to achieve his ends? This is a possible God, but a hideous God. So the point he was making is, okay, I see the point that you Christians have, but again, why so much pain, suffering, and evil? And the point is, hey, if God wanted a home for human beings, he wouldn't need to put us through so much evil and suffering. And you know, I think what's going on here is that Stenger is minimizing God's ends. He says suffering to achieve his ends. But you know, as I dialogued with him on this, it's like he was only looking at one end. What is necessary from God's perspective to create a home where we human beings can thrive? Well, that's one purpose that God had for creating the universe. It's one purpose for the evil and suffering he's subjecting us to. But he's assuming there are not more purposes. And we're actually going to spend some time, probably not this week, but next week, looking at all the biblically stated purposes for God creating the universe the way he did, and for why God exposes us to the degree of evil and suffering that he does. But what I find most interesting and ironic is that these rebuttals in the atheistic community are being parroted by Christians and the young earth creationist community. We have young earth creationists basically making the same point that these atheists are. This is an example in a book written called The Answer Book and by Ham, Sarfati, and Wieland. And then the same point made by Kelly, the theologian Kelly, in his book Creation and Change, basically saying that the death, bloodshed, disease, suffering before Adam's sin, which is a key point of old earth, they're basically saying that they're using this as an argument against a universe and an earth that's billions of years old. So the earth is billions of years old, then you've got death and bloodshed and disease and suffering occurring before Adam sinned. And they said that would be incompatible with a loving creator. And I find that this is a ubiquitous charge made by people who write within the young earth creationist community, and basically saying an all-loving creator wouldn't be subjecting his creatures to this degree of death, bloodshed, disease, and suffering. And therefore, they claim there is no cancer until Adam's sin. They're basically putting all the blame on Adam. And I've made the point in my books, we need to realize Adam's not the first sinner. Satan is the first sinner. and we do not know. The Bible is silent on when Satan first rebelled against God. And if God is all-knowing, then he would know that sin is coming, and therefore it'd be well within his means to create the universe in advance with the features that would deal with the problem of sin and evil. So, death, bloodshed, disease, and suffering before Adam's sin is incompatible. But likewise, I'm saying, young earth creationists, just like the non-theists, are minimizing the purposes for God exposing us to evil and suffering. Now, they're not doing what the non-theists are doing, where they're saying there's just one purpose. Young earth creationists do admit there's more than one purpose. But what we're going to be talking about when we get into this next week, we're not talking just one, two, or three purposes. I've read some young earth literature where they acknowledge three distinct purposes for the evil and suffering we're going through right now. But I'm going to show you that there's at least a dozen distinct purposes. And with a dozen distinct purposes, it becomes clear why it's necessary for God to expose us to the degree of evil and suffering he does. In the sense that, and here's another young earth quote for you. This is from Henry Morris II when he was still alive. And when he was alive, he was the most prominent of the young earth creationist leaders. He wrote this in Recent Creations of Vital Doctrine. He said, the very concept of geological ages implies divine confusion and cruelty. He basically says, we're going to accept billions of years of life history on Earth. That means we've got a lot of extinction events and speciation events. It makes it look like God doesn't know what he's doing. And then he basically says it involves so much death that you're basically saying that God is cruel. Again, he's overlooking the reasons and the purposes for having multiple speciation events and multiple extinction events. As I explained before, this is a key feature for the Creator to compensate for the brightening of the sun while ensuring that our planet Earth is endowed with a huge abundance and diversity of life, not just for a few thousand years, but for billions of years, so that we humans, when we come up on the scene, have this huge treasure chest of biodeposits that's been built up for us over billions of years. If you want to learn more about that, I discuss that in my book. It's both in Weathering Climate Change and Improbable Planet, how it's necessary to have these mass speciation and mass extinction events going on for billions of years in order to be able to compensate for the brightening of the sun. So as the sun gets brighter and brighter, the greenhouse gases of Earth's atmosphere, thanks to life of just right life at just right times, we have the greenhouse effect getting progressively weaker and weaker as the sun gets brighter and brighter. So the temperature on the surface of the Earth remains optimal for life throughout that whole period of time. And I'd like to suggest an analogy here that might help all of us respond to both young earth creationists and non-theists when they basically say, there's too much evil, there's too much suffering. An analogy, I'd like you to think about the most difficult, the most challenging class you ever took, either as a graduate student, undergraduate, or in high school. Think of that most difficult class you ever took. And while you were taking it, you probably weren't aware why that class had to be as tough as it is. But once you got through that class and had a few years under your belt in your career, you began to look back on that and say, now I understand why that class had to be so tough, because that class was preparing me for challenges I was not fully aware of. In terms of going to the gym, they say no pain, no gain. If you want to become physically strong, you need to go to the gym and subject yourself to some temporary suffering there at those machines and weights, etc. We all do that, try to keep our bodies in condition, but to do so, it requires going through some level of discomfort for a brief period of time. I think there's two things that motivate us. Number one, that really tough course we took, it didn't last forever. It was over with within a semester or a year. And so it was temporary. We realized that, yes, that course is going to involve some significant suffering as I prepare to pass that test, but it's not going to last that long. And then realize, hey, that's really going to benefit. And I saw that personally. When I was an undergraduate, I took a 2-unit course that required 25 hours a week to be able to keep up. Toughest course I ever took. And I managed to talk to the physics professors and say, 25 hours is a lot to be able to do well in this class. How come we're only getting 2 units? And they said the university won't allow us. They put a maximum of 18 units per year on each student. And so they said, yeah, we can only give you 2 units in spite of the fact it takes 25 classroom hours to get through it. However, I can look back on that course now. As challenging and difficult as it was to pass that course, I look back on it now and say, if it wasn't for that course, I wouldn't have been adequately prepared for the challenging thesis that I undertook when I was in graduate school. And so I'm very grateful for that course. I'm still benefiting from that course to this day. When I was a postdoctoral fellow, I didn't fully appreciate how much I benefited from that really challenging course. Did that course involve a whole lot of suffering? It certainly did. I mean, I was sweating bullets trying to keep up with that class and all the other classes I had that were likewise involving way more classroom hours than we got credit for. So that was actually the most challenging year I ever had in my educational system. Graduate school seemed like a piece of cake after my 4th year undergraduate. I was going to a university where they were squeezing 5 years into 4 years. But there again, I saw the benefit. By having 5 years squished into 4 years, it made me work really hard and really focus in an intense way. And it gave me a huge advantage over my other fellow graduate students and when I went on to graduate school, and likewise when I went on to do research at Caltech. And I'm basically making the point, it's the same way here. And we're actually going to get into that in some detail when we look at that. And I see that we're actually at 11:13. What I'm going to do, let me stop the share here. I'm going to set you up. Last week, we looked at this verse in 2 Corinthians 4:16-17. And I'm going to quote the verse. We do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. And I'm going to have to go back to share screen, because what I'm going to do is show you the URL. So let me go back here. This is all stuff that I really thought we were going to get to today before we go into our breakout groups. But I want to make sure we got time in our breakout groups. Here it is. Okay. What I want to do is have all of you write this down. This is the invitation, URL you're going to need to get into the meeting, and write down the passcode 352841. And the Zoom address, https://zoom.us/j/82048364. And I got to move this over so I can see the last number. 16. I thought it was 6. Again, the number 820-483-65416. the passcode 352841. You're going to need to give me a minute to be able to get this Zoom up and running. I haven't got it up and running yet, but once we do, I'm going to be able to break all of you up into small groups where we're going to discuss this principle. Here are the questions that we're going to look at. Okay, we got the world believing that this whole universe is subject to naturalistic evolution and thermodynamics. That explains the evil and suffering. One way I think we can challenge that, I mentioned this last week, what we see when we give our lives to Jesus Christ and allow the Holy Spirit to begin to work within us, we see reverse entropy going on. Yes, our bodies are decaying, but our spirits being renewed day by day, or day by day, we're achieving more of the character features that we see in Jesus Christ, becoming more Christ-like, literally on a daily basis. And my point is, if unbelievers can see this anti-entropy operating within the lives of believers, it's going to give them some hope that there really is an answer to the evil and suffering around us. Not everything is subject to this ongoing decay that only affects the physical realm. There's something going on in the spiritual realm. And I also want you to talk about how we can't explain evil just from pure physics and chemistry. Something besides physics and chemistry is needed to explain the evil, or to put it in the context of what Pascal wrote. He said, when we look at the human species, we see that we are wretchedly evil than beyond anything we can explain by natural processes. At the same time, we're miraculously virtuous in a way that can't be explained by anything going on in the natural realm. There has to be a spirit realm. There has to be a God. There has to be a God that's exposed by a supernatural evil being. So that's what I want you to talk about. I'm going to give you about 15 minutes to talk about this. There'll be groups and you'll have full video capability. So with that, I'm going to stop the share. I assume all of you have got this up and there. In fact, I'll leave this up a little longer because I'm going to go to my other computer and actually, here we go. I'll let you know when I got the meeting up and running.
So Hugh, are we all to sign out and sign back in with that new address?
That will be the case, yes.
Although, okay, am I supposed to stay here and direct people?
Yeah, you'll stay there, so don't sign out. Okay. I'm gonna have you there because I know we're gonna get some people to join us late. We do every week, just because we are operating in different time zones. So you'll be there. The webinar will still be up and running, and we're going to leave it up and running. But I'm going to launch this other meeting. But give me a moment. And again, next week, this will be automatic, hopefully, or 2 weeks from now. But today, this is the way we're going to do it. Oh, I got the wrong password in it. Hang on. Ah, I misspelled my email address. Okay, I'm now starting the meeting. They'll be able to get in soon. Oh. I'm going to have to end the other meeting. I'm sorry. I thought this was going to work.